Hi again, everybody.
Oh, hey.
So we're going to start this panel discussion. So let's start with a question for James, because he's just finished his talk. So James, as a McGill graduate, and also somebody who went to the BAM Center a bit more than 10 years ago, what do you think is super important to teach in university curriculums?
So I think listening to Paul's presentation, every time he was talking about the informal learning sort of criteria and process, that was all resonating very much with me. And I think kind of the key to audio training is the provision of knowledge and the teaching of ability. So I think the ideal program would be something that provides a base knowledge so that people can build understanding and from that launch into further understanding and analysis on their own, and provides the opportunity to practice so that you can build that ability. Because when I graduated from my schooling and, you know, hit the mean streets of the world, it was like, you know, being clubbed over the head with the need to be efficient, the need to be fast. And one of the things that Leonard saw in the analysis of the studios in Bamako was how fast they were. Just absolute speed, absolute efficiency, absolute ability to be practitioners of studio production without it interfering with being musical creators and musical collaborators.
And do you have an idea of a specific class that could do that and how?
Basically, what I think is that doing it in a class is almost impossible, and you need to have an in-studio component that is high volume and in terms of time and low amounts of people. So just meaningful engagement from students in studio sessions. And I don't know how to do that in like a large class size environment, other than just to have many studios running around the clock, but just to be in sessions and to be interacting with musicians and to learn from that experience and that sort of somebody looking down your shoulder or looking through the glass and starting to tap their foot and saying like, what's going on? What's going on? Why hasn't it happened yet? Why hasn't it happened yet? Like building the skill to function quickly because of those situations and to continue functioning in those situations, I think can't really be simulated. It has to be real.
James, you mentioned Ken and his process of mixing and around the idea of starting with the vocal rather than starting with the drums and working your way up. And obviously, you know, starting with the drums is very much a rock paradigm, and it's a bottom-up mixing approach. And I first came across top-down mixing when I first interviewed Phil Harding, who mixed a lot of pop records in the 1980s and through to the 1990s for Stock, Aitken and Waterman, Kylie Minogue, Rick Astley, E17. And he came across that too. In pop music, the most important thing is the vocal. And so he starts with the vocal and works his way back down to the drums. I thought it was interesting that actually from that example that you talked about was that Ken was coming, you know, he's coming from a similar place as Phil where the vocal is most important, but it was actually Ken's influence on the rest of the class that allowed the class to see another way of doing things.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have a lot of that cultural exchange within the Banff Center.
A lot. And the student population at the center is often maybe 2/3 people coming from school programs and 1/3 people who've sort of been more self-taught. And the comment that I always get from the people coming from a more sort of traditional Anglo-American schooling background is how eye-opening it was to be in a place where everyone came from somewhere different because they learned an approach from their school or an approach from their professor. And they come here and they get to sort of sample this melting pot of approaches. And something like Ken's example where, you know, if they had done more research, if they had learned from someone who had a sort of vocals down mix approach, it wouldn't have been so mind-blowing for them. But just to have somebody bring in something that was new, and even specifically Ken's angle of focusing on building the space around the vocal before doing any timbral or dynamics processing. So that was kind of two curveballs for most of the people in the group. And it was really great to see the sort of like light bulb moment where, you know, maybe that hasn't changed every single mix they do, but it has changed their approach to coming up with an approach.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that. And I don't know, Maëlle, if you have a comment on that, because you learn your own skills. Basically, you were self-taught, right, for DJ practice?
Yeah. I'm a self-taught musician and producer. I guess like the difference from my own experience is that practice is mostly based on hardware devices, and I've also been able to spend a lot of time in professional studios with, like, you know, SSL consoles and hardware compressors and that kind of stuff. So even though I don't have a formal training, I've spent so much time around this kind of gear that I think I got influenced in my way in working. Even when I'm working with software, I've been influenced by the more conventional approach to, you know, sound production, mixing, mastering, all that things. And that's the thing I found out, like, in Dakar, is that for most of the beat makers I've worked with, they don't have any kind of hardware experience. So, you know, they've never touched even a mixer. So their approach to which tools they're using and how they're using it, it's not based on replicating the studio, the hardware, traditional studio experience, but it's more like a problem solving workflow where they're going to have one issue and they're trying to fix that issue and then move on to the next one, which is quite interesting somehow, because like all the DAWs, all the plugins, they're designed to emulate the physical studio experience. So it's like a different reality somehow, because for them, they don't even register the fact that these tools they're using are like some kind of emulation or replication of a physical device that actually exists.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you a question, because obviously you've come from a background that's based on the physical processes and instruments within the recording studio context. Did you, from what you observed, did you see any of the participants using a piece of gear that you know really well and know how to use? Did you observe them using it differently? Sorry, the emulation of the hardware.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, of course. But like, as I was saying, I think that it was completely different to anything I've seen or anything I would do myself, the way they're using these plugins. And as I was saying, it's more like I have this kick drum and it doesn't sound right, so I'm going to fix that thing on the spot. And the whole like composition, production, recording, editing, mixing, everything happens at once. And so they'll be going from one problem to a solution, to another problem, to another solution, and using the plugins, not really as plugins, but more like as a collection of presets that they know will be able to fix things that they need to be fixed during the process. And I think, because you guys were talking about, I mean, education, and I think there's a connection between the workflow of these beatmakers and the way they learn studio techniques, because I've been conducting interviews also, and I've been interested a lot into how they got their skills, how they got the knowledge, and mostly like 99% of that, it comes from YouTube studio tutorial channels. So they will, they will find one video when they need to understand something specific because they have an actual problem they need to fix. And I guess that's like translating into the way they're producing and mixing and everything.
Just to sort of add on to that, like one of the things that I saw a lot with Ken in person and that has been sort of echoed in all of the field research from Amandine, is that the difference between that sort of learning in a purely software environment without any sort of gaze on the hardware influenced sort of methodologies that a lot of us kind of come from. Simple, like little things like any parallel effects were never done through auxes and busing like that. It was always just an insert with a mix knob.
Mm-hmm.
But also it seems to have informed things like the very kind of core of the methodology of, do we track and then edit and then mix and then master, or are all of those things happening sort of in this like seamless ebb and flow until when we decide that the song is done, that's when it happens to have been edited, mixed, and mastered. But all of those things are happening from the presets you choose on the track before the artist even walks in to the arrangement edits you're making at the very last second. And it's sort of mind-blowing to see that and think like, why am I being held down by the fact that 30 years ago, you had to wait until you were done recording before you could whip out a razor blade and do any editing, before you could put it into the mixer and do any mixing. Like that sort of needing to wait for one process to be done before the next process starts makes me feel like a dinosaur now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about it. And it's quite mind-blowing to see it happening, because it actually turns out to be a really efficient way to work.
Yeah.
And I think, Leonard, it's what you had also noticed when you started analyzing the sessions. And so I want to know how you did it before you went to school, when you were producing your own music. Were you following a certain sequence, or were you doing all at once? And
I didn't have a whole lot of experience producing my own music, recording my own stuff before coming to school. But I do actually recall my I guess the recordings that I had to submit for my entrance into the digital audio arts program. And I remember a very specific example of something that I did. So, like Mile was mentioning earlier, I didn't know how to fit the drum track into this mix for my entrance mix. And I decided to just look up what other people were doing on YouTube. And the weird part of this whole thing was in this YouTube video, it just told you, it basically explained, you know, concepts of compressing, like the kick and the snare, obviously. But I didn't think that these methods were specific to recording actual drums, because what I was doing was I was trying to fit in MIDI drums into this track. But when I watched this video that said, you know, you should be compressing the kick, you should be compressing the snare, you know, you need to cut out all of the low from you know, your cymbals, I did that to my MIDI track, which was already processed. I listened to exactly what they said, and I was unable to, you know, it might have been mentioned, but I was just unable to actually differentiate between how you treat a MIDI track to how you treat an actual acoustic drum set. Just going back on it, that was something that I noticed, and it kind of added to the admiration of, you know, like obviously these Malian producers who were watching these videos, and not only were they in the language that they didn't, a lot of the times they didn't understand, it wasn't their mother tongue or anything like that. But like sometimes the videos wouldn't include information because the person making the video thought that this information was obvious.
Yeah, for sure. And I explained to Leonard and all the students who analyzed the sessions from Mali, but when I went there and I asked them, why do you use this preset? Like, and the preset is called snare. And the answer is not because snare is a caisse claire in French, right? They don't understand the word snare necessarily. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So they just think that one sounds like a certain way and they want to apply it because it will fix the problem they have a certain way. Because they always like it also. Some preset on vocal, they treat them as well as I would treat a reverb effects, because I know it sounds like this or this. But it's an EQ, and so there's a part of me that is like, well, it would be good to show you how to use an EQ, but in another way, it's like, well, they associated a certain type of result with that certain preset, so it's efficient. And with the number of presets that exist and the number of plugins that they have enough of a palette of EQs they can use. So that's a, I think it's an interesting way to use the DAO that I think I changed a little bit my way of teaching EQing and compressing, knowing this basically.
So what, Amadine, what did you, how have you changed the way that you teach?
Well, the first thing is I used to tell my students not to use presets. I used to tell them, you know, you need, because, you know, if you record a snare drum, depending how you record it, what kind of, you know, microphone, what kind of snare, what kind of drummer, what kind of room you're using, you're not going to get the same type of snare drum result. So the preset snare may or may not be appropriate, you know. I was trying to undo this idea that, like, if you want your kick to sound good, you need to boost this frequency and cut this frequency. And I thought, because I think it's just like a recipe and it's sad, you know. Now I'm just like, if you used to use presets, use the preset, but question it, you know. Is it really bringing what you want? So instead of telling them to use the gear, like I learned how to use the gear, I try to be in between, basically. And start where they start. Like, for example, also I used to tell them not to to use templates in their DAO, you know, because students will show me their DAO sessions and there's the same EQ, the same compressor twice on every channel, you know, and I'm like, well, okay, you have the CPU to use it, but why are you doing it? You don't even know what you need and don't need these effects. But now I don't do that because I understood that the SSL duality is already a template. And if I think it's a cool template, why do I think that their DAO template is not that cool? So I stopped doing that. And I'm just like, again, just questioning, why do you use two EQs? Are you sure you need those two? What was the process? You know, because very often one EQ is counterbalancing the other one, meaning like they push one too far and they come back with the other one or things like that. And I just try to look at it a different way, basically. But I have a question for you, Paul. So doing this research that you did in the UK with DJ artists and hip-hop artists, I think, who were self-taught, how did it influence your way of teaching and your design of the audio curriculum in your university?
Well, I think that Amile will probably be able to speak a bit more about this. But the thing that I found that's actually been key to all of these discussions and the discussions that we found from that study and the study with audio professionals who've undertaken an apprenticeship is the fundamental nature of watching and then copying. Mm-hmm. And observation is absolutely key. And I think that audio education probably needs to take observation a little bit more seriously. It's not always possible. You know, the structures that surround higher education, for example, they can be incredibly constraining. They might be around timetabling. They might be around room availability. And now we're in COVID-19. They're going to be, the constraints are going to be about social distancing and how we make those particular resources available to people. But it also provides, you know, an opportunity for us, you know, potentially offering an observational aspect where we can maybe film a session and then students can watch it back without having to be physically present. And students learn a lot from other students. You know, it allows us to question quite rightly and reflect on what we as educators and us who, you know, who work in formal education, how we go about integrating informal learning practices into that process. I think we have an opportunity to do that in some instances, and in some instances we don't, because of the formal structures that surround what we do. And actually we need to get better at talking about the things that don't work sometimes, and including a lot more of those rather than the things that necessarily did work. Because as we all know, we learn way more from our mistakes than we do from our successes. And I thought that was a key point from the research that I'd conducted from an industry professional, is that the toolbox has two sides. You know, you can use your toolbox to fill in the things that you are going to use. And then you can fill your toolbox on the other side that says the things that we know don't work. We've seen it not working. So we'll avoid doing that. And I think that's key as well to, you know, a lot of the studies that have been conducted around the world that you've seen musicians and music producers working efficiently because they've found what works. What we haven't probably seen is the development process of them finding that the things that didn't work before they got to that particular point. So I think what audio education can learn from this is to be a little bit more honest sometimes, and a little bit more open, and maybe emphasize a little bit more about some of the failures rather than some of the successes.
Wow.
Anybody want to share any of their failures right now?
No, I don't know. Just to react to what you were just saying, I think maybe the work we've been doing, like what Amandine and Emmanuel have been doing in Mali, or what I'm trying to do in Senegal, the main purpose of that work is research for now, but maybe it could be used or it could be an inspiration for educational programs as well, just for students to be able to have access to production sessions in studios which are like completely different to the environment they used to, and to have access to different practices, different habits, different techniques. And I think it could also be really beneficial for students to have access to this kind of material in the other way around also.
Absolutely. You know, it's remembering that this is a two-way process, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
And just by watching anybody, you'll learn something new. You know, it's the age-added thing of, you know, everybody you meet knows something you don't, and your job is to find out what that is, in a way. And I think that's the key to good research, isn't it? Is finding out, okay, what is it that we're not doing? And I think, Mayo, as well, that you know, a lot of us are aware that we're acutely working in an Anglo-American paradigm which is based around pop and rock music, and that, and the tools are designed around the production of those as well. And some of those tools have been designed around emulation, so they are designed to work or be used within a cultural context. And so when you take those tools out of that cultural context, it's really fascinating to see what happens in Senegal and Mali, how musicians use them. I was wondering if there's any particular examples from anyone around that saw something that you're going to steal for your toolbox.
No, I mean, like one particular example, it's not exactly the situation you're describing, but I've seen beatmakers in Dakar using the tools that they have, something like a contact sampler, to design virtual instruments that they use to replicate traditional, more maybe more precisely local instruments. And I was wondering why they were doing that, because the process was actually that they would call in a musician who would like perform on the drums or on a synthesizer, and then slice up the individual drum hits and load them into a contact sampler and make it a virtual instrument. And then I understood that it was actually so that it would make it easier for them to include these sounds into their particular production process, because it's much easier for them to include sounds that have already been processed. So they would just record this instrument and then process all the individual sounds and then build an instrument within Kontakt that they can actually use in a track later on.
I think something that I've seen pretty often on a, just to go back on something that's present in a lot of plugins, which is just the level of the plugin. that you can adjust. Something that I've seen pretty often is that the producer will actually adjust the level of the plugin, and then they'll adjust the clip gain, and then they'll adjust the fader. They could adjust the group that the track is present in, but they don't feel like these are different from each other. It's just when they have that window present and they want to change the volume, the level of the track, they just do it. And looking at my own practice, I constantly, you know, like if something is just, if a track is just too loud, you know, I'll go back into the mix window and I'll lower the fader. And I will just do that. And I'll make that extra step, say, to get to my mix window, thing that I'm very familiar with. You know, you look at a console, if you're at a show or something, you know, you see all the faders and you're like, that edits the volume. But with what I've seen, these volume producers, they don't see that as a necessity. They're able to remove themselves from thinking that the faders are what controls the level. It's just interesting to see the logic and how they can behave like that. And it does make me question, like, why I do think that the fader, the actual fader, is the only thing that I should be using to control the volume of something.
It's great. I think it also speaks to Miles' observations that, you know, it's mixing as you go. If you adjust the clip gain or whatever it is as you go, then it's almost irrelevant where the fader is at that particular point. It's solving that problem at that particular point in time, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's great.
Yeah. A lot of gain staging ideas. Love it for sure. I mean, it's interesting to look at cultures, I think, in general, to inform the way we teach, right? Because I think there's the culture of musical genres that we are aware of, but we can only teach the genres we have been working in. Seriously, I mean, I listened to a lot of hip hop, but I didn't work in hip hop. So I don't necessarily know how to make it sound like hip hop, you know? Even though I know what hip hop sounds like very well, but it's a difficult one to teach. And I found that this kind of anthropological approach we were doing in Mali and Senegal and other countries in West Africa, I think it's a way to approach a mixture of musical genres with cultures and find different ways to do things and teach them back, I guess. But not in the sense that I will be like, hey, I saw that in Mali, you should do this way, but more like, here is a session from Mali, watch it, analyze it, and take it as you want. But yeah, that kind of thing.